Hi, I'm Mark O'Neill. I'm a former head of Glasgow Museums, and this talk is going to be an exploration of the role of museums in public health, looking back to the Victorian period when museums were part of a broad social movement to improve people's quality of life, including parks and libraries. And I'm going to bring that up to date with the recent history of Glasgow Museums, and then look to the future to explore whether Glasgow Museums can make a bigger contribution to the health and well-being of the entire community of the city. Thanks very much, Pete. I need to set up my timer, given the threat that was made earlier. Yes, these introductions are beginning to sound more and more like obituaries, which I suppose is appropriate for a health talk. I'm not going to cover quite 200 years, and I'll explain why in a second. Just to give you, those of you who like to know where it's going, those of you who are happy to go with the flow, you can ignore this. I'm going to say a few words to situate museums in the arts and health sector, but mostly I'm going to focus on arts and health in a way that's deeply rooted in Glasgow's museums and traditions. And I'll explain why it's the late Victorian period. I'll then say a bit about public health and then talk about contemporary evidence. And the second part of the talk is going to look at the more recent history of Glasgow museums, the second great period of investment, and speculate about what museums can contribute to health, and then what Glasgow museums in particular could bring to the kind of debate that Pete is talking about. So, those of you who are not familiar with the museums and health world may not be aware, but all over the world, the museums are engaging in health-related activities. These are three dementia projects in Zurich, Liverpool, and New York, just to give you a sample. And this is an American Alliance of Museums report from 2013, which outlines the range of health issues that museums have become involved in, everything from actually promoting healthy information to working with people with mental health issues or visual impairments. So a whole range of issues. There's also a recent spate of publications about the issue that Museums Health and Wellbeing is 2013, and just earlier this year, the Oxford Textbook on Public Health published a book on creative arts, health and wellbeing, which has a number of chapters about museums. So I suppose the big obvious question is this just a fad? Is this just desperate cultural institutions trying to justify their existence in the face of dwindling funds and trying to find a new relevance? And second big question for me is, if museums can make a difference to health on a large scale, public health, what is the best way of doing that? In terms of public health, which is not my area of expertise, I'm going to rely on Phil Hanlon and his Glasgow University colleagues' schematization of public health into these four great waves. And he says there's an emerging, or there's a need to have a fifth wave, which focuses on, takes a more integrative, holistic approach to deal with the psychosocial problems of today. For the historical period, I'm going to focus on the early phases when the classic health interventions that Pete mentioned, clean water, sewage, and actually trying to understand what caused infectious diseases which people struggled with. And then the second phase, which was very much when it was fully professionalized, museums professionalized at the same time, some with positive consequences, some less positive. So that's the public health background. I'm not going to quite do the past 200 years. I'm going to say nothing about the Hunterian, which was the first purpose-built museum and art gallery in Britain, opened in 1807 in this famously beautiful Palladian building, which the Victorians vandals demolished. This is the High Street, and that's the old university, just where the High Street railway station is now. And that's the museum just behind it. The university sold this to the railways when they moved up to Gilmore Hill. I'm also not going to say anything about the Andersonian Institute Museum, which opened in the 1830s. And that's what's now Strathclyde University. The reason I'm not going to say much about the Hunterian is that it didn't really engage with a broad public and had a very clearly scholarly agenda, engaging mostly with students and academic educated visitors. the Andersonian engaged with. Can you see the slides? Could we have the lights down? Are you okay? And the bifocal isn't confusing you. They had a strong program of working class education, which was part of the foundation of the Mechanics Institute. But in the 1860s, they decided they needed this space for lectures and actually handed the collection over to the Hunterian. The McClellan Galleries was the first civically funded art gallery in Britain, opened in 1857. But the city was bounced into this by the bequest of Archibald McClellan and complicated, somewhat shady arrangements about his will. And the city didn't really know what to do with it for about 20 or 30 years until they worked out how to use this. I can tell you the story about the will later. So the first civic museum that fits my narrative is 1870. So it's coming up to its 150th, not its 200th anniversary, in 2020. But I want to digress here briefly to say a bit about what Glasgow was like in 1870. You're familiar with the whole story of the squalor of the slums and the huge wealth that was also being made here. But learning from the past is quite difficult because, as the L.P. Hartley novel famously says, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there, and it's difficult to learn. So just some basic facts. Very few people had the vote, and £10 annual rent was a huge amount of money, but even still, people didn't sign up for the vote because they didn't want to be caught for rates. There was no compulsory primary education. That didn't come in until 1872, and it was after 1872 it was compulsory, but it charged. There were no old age pensions until 1906, no unemployment insurance until 1911. The city didn't manage the poor relief, that was the Poor Law Guardians, and they didn't manage education. The school boards were separate bodies. So a very different, very male-dominated world with lots of different assumptions from what we would have today. Public health in Glasgow was a huge issue. The police acts were very important because before formal health legislation, the city tried to manage controlling things like waste and human waste, industrial waste, food regulation, was all managed through the police, and they had health police. And you can see the rate of activity increases as the century goes on, with the first part-time medical officer of health, sanitary commission committees, municipal washhouses, the first fever hospital. And you can see the contagious diseases that rake through the city with devastating consequences. And of course, diseases didn't disproportionately affected the poor because of overcrowding, but they didn't exclusively affect the poor. These were an issue for rich people as well. So they had an interest in dealing with these. Loch Katrine Water, of course, is the famous intervention by the city. The city's first full-time medical officer of health was James Byrne Russell, appointed in 1872, and his priorities were overcrowding, infectious diseases, and statistics, counting, keeping track of improvements, understanding the spread of infections was all managed through gathering statistics. He was in his post for 26 years, during which time the death rate fell from 28 plus per thousand to just under 20 per thousand from 1872 to 1894. He was a prolific writer. His lecture, Life in One Room, had a big effect on the better-off classes in Glasgow, communicating what the reality of life was like in overcrowded conditions. He talked about Glasgow as a semi-asphyxiated city, and so he brought in reforms like the compulsory notification of infectious diseases. Against huge opposition, landlords actually objected to collecting human waste because there might be a market for it, even if the owner of the waste couldn't be identified. So the assumptions that private enterprise would solve all problems was charity was a big issue at the time as well. He became internationally famous as a leading practitioner of public health. Between 1870 and 1914, Glasgow more than doubled in size, partly due to population growth, partly due to acquiring neighbouring areas. if you were it went into Partick in certain parts of Partick in 2012, they were still regretting this in the centenary of annexation by Glasgow and how things have gone downhill ever since. But Glasgow boomed, well, it boomed and slumped. There were periodic slumps with massive unemployment and poverty with peaks as well. But the city became fabulously wealthy. Lots of new buildings like the university, the city chambers, which opened in 1888 and coincided with the first vast industrial exhibition as Glasgow projected itself overseas. And you can see some of the other innovations here. At this time, Glasgow was the fifth or sixth biggest city in Europe. London, Paris, Berlin, Vienna and Glasgow. So huge, huge and significant city. In 1914, Glasgow published a new edition of its description of its evolution and enterprises. So 340 pages of detailed description of a vast enterprise, many functions that the public services no longer do today, most of which had been developed in this 40-year period using the organisational power that they had learned through their capitalist enterprises. Albert Shaw was an American journalist and academic who wrote a book called Municipal Government in Great Britain, and he wrote a book about Europe, municipal government in Europe as well. And he, this is a quote from the book, he saw Glasgow as the epitome of the modern city using its organisational powers and as a leader in lots of areas, including solving the problems that related to poverty. So the corporation, it's using, I suppose, a capitalist model of what in economics you would call vertical integration, like Carnegie bought not just the steel mill, but the coal mill and the iron mines. So they had everything, quarries and farms. They had their own gas plants and their own electricity plants. They had a number of power stations. The power stations were for the trams, and they ran famous or what Shaw called street railways. And the Glasgow's transport system was emulated around the world. Bombay, Chicago were based on Glasgow. Shaw, very liberal American, but he was disturbed by how much work they were taking on from the private sector. So actually renting houses directly to working class people he saw as stepping over a boundary. These were model tenements that they built after the 1866 Improvement Act. There's a big chapter on public health in this book and tells you there what the 1,200 staff that they employed to do public health did, tuberculosis staff. And the chart shows the decline of the death rate as the even as the population dramatically increased. I'd love to say a lot more about libraries. They're a big part of this story as well, but I don't have time. Glasgow was very late. The ratepayers objected. You had to have a separate referendum to vote for libraries, and the ratepayers objected, so they weren't allowed until 1900. But between 1900 and 1914, Glasgow built 16 new libraries. The fact that they got half the capital from Carnegie was a big help. And there was a huge expansion of parks as well, which were the lungs of the polluted city. I chose this photograph. Just this wheel has been recently reinvented. Park gyms are now very trendy. But this is before Lycra, and obviously before health and safety. So the rationale for all of this was complicated. And just like today, people picked and chose from really contradictory rationales. So there was utilitarian, they look back to all of these people would have had a classical education, they would have known their Latin and Greek, so they look back to the ancient cities. In this period they shifted from looking to Paris to looking to Berlin as a model, and they felt unequal to these cities because of their scale. There was a deep Christian motivation as well. Ruskin was incredibly influential, both as a promoter of the love of beauty and as a social reformer. I'm not going to go into this in detail, but just to draw your attention to the final quote I want to use from Shaw: all the great industries belong essentially to the one working community. So his book on civic government in Britain, he acknowledges all the inequalities and problems, but more than any other city in Britain, there's a sense of the city working together to solve its problems. So back to 1870 and the first museum in Kelvingrove Park. in an old mansion which the city acquired in 1870. It was known as the City Industrial Museum, which is a misnomer because it showed art, archaeology, local history, natural history specimens. You might be cynical about this, and people at the time were cynical. This is a cartoon from Punch in 1843 about the National Gallery, which is sceptical about the edifying impact of art on the poor when they're starving and don't have enough clothes to clothe themselves. However, there is evidence that people in Glasgow were interested in, working class people in Glasgow were interested in museums. This is an exhibition organised by the Central Working Men's Club and Institute in 1866 in a hired hall in Argyle Street. I haven't been able to quite track down where it is. But they got the patronage of the Duke of Argyle and they got amazing loans. Major contemporary artists like Holman Hunt loaned pictures to this exhibition. The city was also looking to Europe for models, and in 1879, James Peyton, the superintendent of museums, went on a European visit. He didn't go to Paris or Berlin. He went to Holland and Belgium. And because, again, if you think of what the civic republican tradition is about, Holland and Belgium were great examples of this. And he went to, Steph from the Hunterian will recognize some of these institutions. But these were museums that weren't about grand national cultures. They were about civic cultures. They celebrated local creativity, local industry, and local artists, as well as international artists. And they also focused on the modern as well as classical and Renaissance works. So the model for museums in Glasgow, inspired by Europe, was about community building, as opposed to just international prestige, which other cities in Britain were doing. After Kelvin Grove was... the City Industrial Museum was set up, they started looking around and started putting on museum exhibitions outside the city centre. So this is the police hall in Tobago Street in the East End. And in 1883, they organised a small exhibition here, mostly using their own collection with some private loans. It got 63,500 visits. They counted everything. It's very good at counting. At a time when the City Industrial Museum was getting about 300,000 visits. The following year, they put one on in the Gorbals in the new wash house and baths, which had a hall attached, which was also the site of the first public library in Glasgow in 1900. The building is now demolished. This was much more ambitious. It was extended twice and they got over 150,000 visitors and sold 6,000 penny catalogues. The quality of the work shown in this exhibition were amazing. They had loans from the V&A and from the Queen. And they also showed major contemporary works. And it wasn't this exhibition, it was the Southside exhibition in 1891. They showed Whistler's Portrait of Carlyle. First time it was shown in Glasgow and the city bought it afterwards, and it was the first Whistler work ever bought by for a public collection in Britain, and it was part of the reason he left his studio to the Hunterian. So all of this energy led to the opening of the People's Palace in 1898, which had a museum room, a picture gallery, and a reading room. Again, this is long before health and safety. They also had concerts, of which 1,200 people used to be crammed in. I don't know what the fire back number is now. But Lord Rosebery, the ex-Prime Minister, I won't read out the quote, you can read for yourself, but obviously it's seen as a respite from the hardship of daily life and as a source of inspiration for what we would now call creativity. Kelvin Grove opened in 1901 it was built mostly with profits from the 1888 exhibition, and they had another global exhibition. This exhibition had 11 million attendances and it was a global event. There was the first tourist homecoming program to bring Americans back, expats to visit Glasgow. So this is another view of it. The rest are all temporary buildings, and you can see they brought gondolas from Venice. There was gondolas on the Kelvin. So this was the largest, greatest achievement of the Victorian Municipal Museum Movement. So very late in Victorian terms, but Glasgow was often late, and then they learned from everybody else and did things bigger than anybody else. They also did this with tar blocks, so it's not a universally good part of the culture. It was closed down at the end of the year of 1901 and opened as a museum in 1902. And the Lord Provost explained what the building was for in these terms. The corporation, at least, were satisfied that art was in itself a refining and improving and ennobling thing. The educational value of the museum and the opportunities afforded the young people and the lads and girls who had possibly outgrown the ordinary day schools and others for still further pursuing their studies and so broadening and enlarging their general culture. The city soon stopped doing temporary exhibitions and acquired three, what we would now call community museums. The mansions in parks that they either purchased or were left in people's wills. Campbell House opened as a museum in Queen's Park in 1896, mainly showing costume and relics from the Battle of Langside. Moses Field House on the bottom left, it was a bequest and it opened as a local museum and in Springburn Park, and the one Toll Cross in the East End was the first children's museum in Britain, inspired by the first children's museum in the world, which was in Brooklyn in 1899. It opened in 1905, so 6 years after that major renovation, Glasgow was picking up that idea and running with it. And 1905 was also a big year because after decades of opposition from Sabbatarians, the museums were opened on a Sunday. Museums were open until 9 o'clock on Saturday night because at this time again, hard to imagine. People were doing this. The average working week was 60 hours over 5.5 or 6 days a week. So museum visiting on your only day off was difficult. And for lots of people, there was an equivalence between visiting the museum on Sunday and going to church, a respectable, worthy, improving activity. So in 1914, Glasgow ran these six museums, the city centre and West End, sort of high prestige venues, and four museums in working class districts. It was spending more on its museums than big cities like Birmingham and Manchester, and there was a strong commitment that these museums were everyone. They were broadly educational. When children, women who at this stage still didn't have the vote, when the education was distributed very unequally, these were seen as major democratic institutions. So our question, I suppose, is, was this unusual? And it wasn't. Lots of museums, the V&A was very radical when it was set up. This is the Whitechapel Art Gallery. The Whitechapel Art Gallery emerged from exhibitions run by Reverend Barnett and his wife, who were very well connected with philanthropic rich people in London, and they ran major exhibitions like the Gorbals ones in the East End of London. In 1901, it got a new building with fully professionalised staff, and it immediately switched from engaging with its local community to showing the best of contemporary art to a much narrower audience. And that shift from being very socially aware, innovative institutions to being much more sort of provider capture in the jargon, much more for people who were already educated, basically, happened in lots of museums across Britain. The V&A was a classic example. When the founding director, Henry Cole, retired, the much more traditional professional staff took over and it changed radically. So what's the link with public health? This is Councillor Crawford, portrait by one of the Glasgow boys. And in Professor Hanlon's categorisation, this period was the one of dealing with all the physical problems which we all know so well. However, Councillor Crawford brought health and museums together. He was James Burns Russell's main political supporter. He was chair of the health committee. He was also chair of the museums committee, and he saw them as part of the same strategy. In 1891, in a speech significantly to the Ruskin Society in Glasgow, the Society of the Rose, explaining why they were planning to build the People's Palace, which opened 7 years later, he asked, Is it possible for any public body to deal effectively with institutions and conditions of life apparently so widely removed as public health and municipal art? You, I am sure, will give no hesitating answer to this question. It is of the very essence of that common bond which links together the members of this society that these two extremes not only do, but must meet and blend together to their mutual advantage. The heart that vibrates to the truly beautiful in art will vibrate also to human suffering. What today we would call empathy, which is because it's neurologically proven to exist, is now very fashionable. But for Crawford and for many liberals inspired by Ruskin, lifting the human spirit through culture was an essential part of the programme for reform. I don't know if this is a significant qualification of this Hanlon categorisation, but obviously the vast majority of public health effort was going into dealing with the physical problems, but if you put libraries, museums and parks together, there was another cultural dimension. So to try to summarise this section, this, by the way, is a cartoon from a Glasgow paper showing typical visitors to Kelvin Grove on a Saturday evening. On the basis of all those rationales I talked about earlier, liberal reform, Ruskinian social reform, museums were seen as part of a democratic educational program, part of a much wider program of progressive reform to improve people's lives. And they combined idealism about beauty with pragmatism about, you know, people need to get jobs and art is a way to get jobs. The museums were for international prestige as well as binding the community into what Disraeli called one nation. But crucially for tonight, they weren't about the past, they were about the future. They were the future the city was trying to build. There's an amazing editorial in the Herald in 1908 for Ruskin's, I think it's his 89th birthday, which merited a half-page editorial. And they said the one thing he was wrong about was his vehemence of his social critique, because the problems industrial society were going through were inevitable but temporary. They were all going to be solved quite soon, and they knew what they were doing. It turned out that they were wrong about that, and even the massive welfare state hasn't solved them. But they had an amazing confidence again, which I think is unimaginable now, that they knew what the problems were, they could solve them, they had the organisational skills. And so museums were part of all of this. So, museums are good for you is a big belief. Were they right? Was it just wishful thinking? A sort of let them eat cake approach to culture? And I mean, Pete says that he's not particularly interested in the evidence of impact, but I think anybody. Oh, that's a very, sorry, crude summary. Of course, he's interested. But anybody who works in museums, I think, has a responsibility to understand if what kind of difference, if any, we're making. And I was fascinated to discover about 10 years ago now 15 or 20 studies by epidemiologists that found that regular cultural attendance has a significant impact on health. Not workshops, not art therapy, just attending museums, the cinema, live music in particular. And these are large-scale studies. This one, I think, had 10,000 people over 14 years. They're controlled for gender, economic status, education, and chronic illness. And crucially, they're not done by museum people trying to justify their existence. They're people looking for patterns in society. One of the obvious criticisms is that the controls are wrong, that it's healthy people just do more stuff than less healthy people. Is there, which way does the causal vector run, or is there any cause and effect? This study by Johansson and others, which is again a big study, 3,800 people over 12 years, found that people who became culturally active acquired health benefits, and those who stopped being culturally active lost the health benefits. And their conclusion was that the results, if repeated, could be in agreement with a causal influence of cultural stimulation. Even more explicit is this study about cancer and cultural attendance. Most of these are Scandinavian, I assume, because there's nothing else to do in the winter except study each other and look, pore over the statistics. But they defined the frequencies of cultural attendance, as you can see it there. So moderate cultural attendance is going once every 1 or 2 months. And they found that, you can read it, but basically regular attendance attendees had a significantly reduced rate of cancer in that large population group. Again, it was controlled for smoking, physical activity, education, income, and chronic conditions. This isn't a museum study, it's a library study, a reading study, but I think it's interesting because they found that 70-year-old men in Israel who read for 20 minutes a day lived longer than those who didn't. So it couldn't have been walking around the galleries, it couldn't have been the social impact, it was just a mental event of some kind, being interested in being alive, some sort of stimulus, although they don't say what they read, which might have been relevant. These patterns, inspired by work we did in Glasgow with GCPH, were found in a Scottish Government study. They found the same patterns of association between cultural attendance and longevity. They, being civil servants, of course, wouldn't commit to where the causality lay, but they did find the same associations. So it's quite powerful. The literature is mostly statistical and they don't speculate. They do occasional speculations, but they don't say much about why museums might have this impact. They talk about the power of objects, the fact that these are resonant, whether they're familiar or exotic, local or global, they have an emotional resonance which can be releasing, it can be experiential, basically very emotional. The buildings can be inspiring and the new interest in place. Museums are very significant places with strong emotional impacts. They're multi-generational, both in the sense that they're amongst the few places where, you know, grandparents, grandchildren, there's a lot of grandparental childminding goes on in Glasgow museums. But also multi-generational in that you can visit a museum your great-grandparents visited. It's the same thing, and there's a sense of continuity, which is a big issue in our culture. Free choice and autonomy. Obviously, we have tried but failed to make museum visiting compulsory. It's still up to you to go. But more importantly, I think, within museums, there are huge choices. You choose your favourites. You choose which ones you don't like. You show your favourites to your friends. So there is a sense of enhancing autonomy. And in Glasgow, crucially, they're hugely owned by the public. There's a really strong sense that the people own these museums. And they're, again, increasingly significantly non-commercial spaces. We do try and make you buy stuff in the shop and a cup of coffee, but compared to lots of places, the commercial pressures are really slight. So I'm going to move on now to the recent history of Glasgow museums. The period before the First World War and the period since 1980 have been the periods of greatest investment, and you'll be relieved now I'm not going to go through all of these. I'm just going to try and identify the strategies that have happened. You can see, again, Glasgow has visitor and statistics going back to the 1870s, which is fantastically interesting for me, possibly less so for normal people. But you can see, since 1980s, they've grown steadily. There was a peak in 1990 during a European City of Culture, and then there were peaks and troughs with the closures, the refurbishment of Kelvin Grove, and the reopening of Riverside. And now, under the current management of Glasgow Museums, they're achieving almost 4 million visits a year, which in a city of 600,000 is amazing. That's all just about the same as what the National Gallery and the National Museums in Edinburgh get combined for, and we won't go into how much more they have, but we'll manage the envy. So, I mean, obviously I worked in Glasgow Museums during most of, as Pete said, since the 1880s. So taking credit for this achievement is not something I'm particularly interested in doing. So to look at it from the outside, there's a famous American blogger called Nina Simon who blogs on Museum 2.0 and has written a book called The Participatory Museums. And last year, the Participatory Museum, she visited Glasgow, and her blog started by saying, what does we mean by audience-centred? By user-centred, she meant deeply engaging, consulting, co-producing with. And there's a case study in her book of Glasgow Museum's outreach department. Customer-centred, she defined as welcoming, friendly, making people feel comfortable, and providing customised bespoke services that mean something to a huge variety of visitors. So after this introduction, she says, what do audience-centred museums look like? And she says, it looks like Glasgow museums. So obviously an intelligent and perceptive woman. But here she summarises the qualities of Glasgow museums. She visited Riverside and Cavan Grove, which she described as great department stores of humanity, and identified their successful customer focus as being down to displays and amenities that were engaging, responsive to different audiences, varied, immersive, interesting, and acknowledging human needs. So looking back on what my colleagues and I did over the past 30 or 40 years, a key thing we did was we shifted from academic presentation to telling human stories. So there are millions of religious objects in museums, but they're never treated as religious, because that's the main human meaning is the religious meaning. But in our Museum of Religion, we tell the religious stories. Kelvin Grove was totally recast from being structured in academic categories to telling human stories, and you have everything from the stories of great art by Dali and Rembrandt to stories from the Holocaust. So Kelvin Grove set out consciously to embrace the widest possible range of human experience instead of, as many museums do, muting the human experience. Sorry, this is the slide I was expecting before. This is the display on angels in the Museum of Religion. And it's the curatorial voice telling you what the objects are. And then there's the voice of the lived experience of a Christian and a Muslim saying what angels mean to them. And that attempt to deepen the human resonance of museums has been a core strategy. The Gallery of Modern Art is very unusual, unlike the Whitechapel Art Gallery, in engaging working class audiences, very broad audiences, with contemporary art. It's the most visited contemporary art gallery outside London. Sometimes Tate Liverpool beats us, but generally that, again, will be competitive. And in the Riverside Museum, it's just two stories. One is about wheelchairs in World War One, and one is about Asians who moved to Glasgow in the 60s to work in the transport system. So there's a conscious effort to represent diversity in the museum stories. Events are a major part of our access strategy, because if you think of what they call anxiety, threshold anxiety, going into a different place, a difficult place, events make that much easier, make that first visit. You can go with friends, you know there's something on where there'll be lots of people milling about, and it reduces the level of formality involved. And every year there's a beach in front of Riverside, which is greatly needed psychologically. And the other thing is making people welcome. Customer service excellence is the Cabinet Office standard for making people welcome in institutions, and Glasgow got the highest mark in Britain last year from anybody in its category. And that isn't, I mean, Glaswegians think of themselves as friendly, but to get it consistently for 4 million visits a year takes a huge culture change from when they used to do security and keep the kids quiet. So that's an amazing cultural shift. The Glasgow Museums also has one of the longest running programs of visitor research. I'm not going to go into detail about this, but actually understanding visitors quantitatively and through qualitative work is a core strategy. So if you think of attracting large numbers of people to the museum based on the evidence that it has an impact in public health terms, it's a sort of a preventive model, I'm crudely calling it that. And the key issue with this is inequality. This is the most recent Glasgow Museum survey, and basically what that complex, I shouldn't have used that, should I? Knows too. Anyway, what it means is that the best off fifth of the population visit roughly twice as much as the worst off fifth. But actually, the fact that 27% of visits to Glasgow museums by Glaswegians are from the bottom quintile is amazing. There's that tradition of working class museum visiting, which goes way back, has been reproduced and continued despite the difficulties, the cost of transport, all those issues. And that, for me, in terms of tonight, gives us a huge base to build on. If those people are coming, other people like them may come. They may come more frequently. They may get more people to come. But it's also important to preserve that in terms of health protection. Jointly with Centre for Population Health, we commissioned a report on cultural participation. And I just thought I'd put up some reasons why people don't come. Museums haven't changed. They're for yuppies. They're for tourists. Obviously, my entire 200-year career was wasted. What was interesting about this, the lack of confidence underlying this about the staff being arrogant and the staff judging people for not knowing stuff, quite painful issues of confidence there. But what I was much more interested in, because none of that's surprising, is why 27% do go. And it was often because a parent or grandparent had taken them. Very few people mentioned school as the source of the influence, and what the marketing report somewhat condescendingly calls positive social norms. Basically, if people worked outside their area or lived in a regenerated area, they were far more likely to visit museums. So the people who really don't visit are trapped in their areas. They don't go for any reason outside their area, and breaking that down would be quite difficult. So one of the ways Glasgow Museums tries to break it down is through outreach, and the Open Museum has been running since 1990, award-winning service, and I'm going to speed up because I have about 15 minutes left. Over that time, they have built up an amazing range of skills and experience. They do specific health projects. They've done projects in mental hospitals. They've done projects with the victims of torture, as well as more general community projects. And you can see here the range of the service and the scope across the city. The evidence, as Pete said, that this kind of work does have an impact, and this book summarizes those impacts across lots of museums. And she's developed a measurement tool that can be used. The issue with all of this, and this is again work we did with Avril Blamey, who's here tonight, about this kind of measurement and this kind of small-scale work, it is actually very difficult to track impacts, very difficult to be clear what you're trying to measure, it's very hard to document, and it's very hard to fund it so that it becomes, to a health practitioner, a recognisable service. These are 12-week or even at the most a year-long project. There are always difficulties with the exit. There's always a sense of abandonment. And the numbers are always quite small. This kind of intense small-scale work is quite difficult to scale up. So if you were going to step back and say, what can Glasgow contribute in the in general terms, the preventive model, I've summarised them here, I won't go over it. But in terms of what Pete was talking about, a broad community creating, working together to create a health-generating or city, this approach should have a big impact. And the service, the skills, the staff who work there and the tradition they work in are appropriate to that, telling the stories that are engaging, egalitarian, all of those things. So back to public health and how this might fit in. Professor Hanlon argues that we need a new model because of the main problems are no longer contagious diseases, but issues of consumerism, a consumer food culture that promotes obesity, massive inequalities, and the things like suicide, loss of meaning for whole social groups, and loneliness is becoming, World Health Organization is talking about loneliness becoming as big a killer as smoking. This is a diagram from a UK government summary of all the evidence on public health, and you can see just the sheer complexity of people's lives and the factors influencing them is massive. This was all reduced to, in the Marmot Review, to these recommendations, and again, I'm not going to read them out. In Professor Hanlon's terms, this is kind of fourth wave, very focused, intervention-based thinking, but merging into the fifth wave. And for Professor Hanlon, these are the kind of recommendations he's making. A much more systemic, whole society approach, but also institutions working to support people to be more resilient and not rely on state prohibition, not relying on the state to manage the consumer pressures becoming stronger and in fending them off themselves, and rebuilding social capital, which has been stripped out both by, in some ways, by the welfare state and by consumerism. So if you were looking at which of those museums could make a contribution to, I've highlighted under the Marmot Review those in red. There's development of children and adults throughout that multi-generational role, very significant, I think. The role of museums in creating healthy and sustainable places, and as a general prevention thing. And I think everything under the fifth wave, you could say that museums could have potentially a huge role in putting forward. So as I move towards a conclusion, this is, you can see museums, the emotional and societal effects of museums in general, Glasgow's specific traditions and expertise, and the fourth and fifth wave of public health. And what I'm arguing this evening is that museums in general, and Glasgow museums in particular, already play a significant role in supporting the health of the whole community, and that along with libraries and parks, they constitute one of the most significant investments in general well-being and preventive health in the city. I'd also argue for people who think that this is a compromised, instrumental use of museums for social purposes, that is not the case. This is what museums, at least in Glasgow, were set up for intentionally and explicitly 150 years ago. And I think Glasgow museums, without undue modesty, have been unusually successful in engaging people from communities whose health is vulnerable, though there is potential to do a lot more. So, what is the best way of tapping into this potential? And I've tried to summarise the issues on this final slide, this final chart. The quote, an integral, ecological, embodied, creative, ethical and reflexive, is Professor Hanlon's summary of what the new emerging system needs to be. And we're still working. Obviously, it's built on the fourth wave of all the interventions. That doesn't go away. So how can museums become part of a more integrated and wider social institutional systems which are dedicated to creating a society which is healthier in a holistic way? This would mean for museums forging new partnerships and finding new ways of developing the museum service, some perhaps not yet envisaged. But at a kind of more basic practical level, in a time of declining resources, it means choosing to explore this territory either through the treatment model, working with small groups and individuals intensively, or the prevention model, working with much larger population groups trying to engage them in museum visiting, or some combination of both, which I'm, as I get older, I find those compromise solutions less and less satisfactory. Let's decide what we're going to do and just do that really well. So I'm going to finish with a question. How do you think Glasgow Museums can best use its resources to support the health of the community? Thank you very much.